Thank you, David. I hope he hasn't given you the wrong impression that this is going to be a stand-up comedy act, which I assure you it is not. But it so happens that this subject, which when David Williams wrote to me on behalf of the committee, I wanted to speak about the Arab world for obvious reasons, but not even I had foreseen that by the time this lecture took place, the Arab world would be in ferment once again. And not just us, but the entire world would be talking about the events that are taking place, even as we gather here in virtually every single country of the Arab East and the Arab West. So the moment is propitious and the timing is right. Now, three elementary points need to be made about this world that we are speaking of. What is it? What was it? What happened to it? And how come it is where it is? If we start with what this world was, it was for many, many years part of the Ottoman Empire. The great Turkish, now Turkey, called Turkey, but the great Ottoman Empire, which was the longest lasting empire in the world, it was, unlike many other empires, quite laid back in the sense that if you paid your dues to the central treasury in Istanbul, they left you alone to get on with it, just keeping an eye to seeing that nothing too naughty was being done. So when the Wahhabi fanatics in Saudi Arabia, led by their founder, Abdul al-Wahhab, decided that they were born again literalist Muslims and they couldn't tolerate any monuments built over the graveyard of the Prophet of Islam or his immediate followers and attacked these and tore them down. This somehow annoyed the Sultan, who was also the caliph of the Muslim world, and he sent in his armies from Egypt, led by an Albanian called Muhammad Ali, and said, go and teach these rogues a lesson. And Muhammad Ali's armies arrived, late 19th century, in the Arab Peninsula, punished the Wahhabis severely, and rebuilt the monuments. And who would have thought that the family or the particular sect punished by the Ottoman Empire would be raised once again from the ashes by first the British and then the American Empire and would still be ruling Saudi Arabia today. But during that period of the Ottoman Empire, the Arab world as we now see it was largely an urban world of cities and a nomadic world of Bedouin tribes, people who move from oasis to oasis, traders, but life was in the large cities. And if you read the memoirs or biographies of some of the great writers of the Arab world, they write quite casually, I went to school in Amman or Jerusalem. After finishing off there, I went to a university in Damascus, and then I went and did my postgraduate degree in Cairo. Just normal. You went from one city to the other. It was all one world. There were no borders, no barriers. They traded with each other. And this world might have gone on. We don't know. It's always impossible to say what might have happened to it had the Ottoman Empire not made a mistake and backed the Kaiser during the First World War. And because of that, it's quite an interesting counterfactual, this. What might have happened to this world had the Ottomans decided to come in with the Allies? You know, they were very fond of monarchies, but, you know, there's no problem there because Britain was a monarchy leading the fight against the German Kaiser. Who knows? One thing is probably certain, that it would have been impossible for the two large powers in Europe, France and Britain to colonize that world, had that happened. But it didn't happen, and this was the punishment inflicted on the Ottoman Empire, that their lands were taken away, or their rule over these lands was removed, and new states were created. And all these states were created after the First World War, in the early years of the 20th century, apart from Egypt, which had an independent life of its own for some time, but nonetheless was still part of that world. And the creation of these new borders did two things. It brought in two huge European empires, one the more powerful, Britain, which got the lion's share of that world. The French had to be given something, and they were allowed influence in Syria, but as a very special treat, they were allowed to carve a coastal strip from Syria and call it Lebanon. That's how that country came into being. And Lebanon, a particular rule was imposed that because the population, the non-Muslim and Muslim populations were 50-50 at the time, that there would always be electoral division of the spoils in Lebanon, so neither side could win, which was true at the time when it was formed in the 20s. But it is certainly not the case now. But everyone thinks to have a new census in Lebanon would be incredibly divisive, apart from those who actually comprise the majority, who feel it would be just. So no, there's been no census in Lebanon since 1936. So no one knows who is the majority and who is the minority. People have a pretty good idea who it is. And one of the demands, which will be bound to be raised now, is let's have a census in Lebanon too. So we shall see what happens in that front. So there was a period of colonial domination, let's call it that, because it wasn't exactly colonial rule, as, for instance, we witnessed in the Indian subcontinent. It was not the case that you had British and French civil servants running every tiny village. That did not happen. But it was essentially military power, military bases that kept the locals who had been entrusted to run these places on behalf of these two empires in place, and there were often uprisings during this period, some during the Second World War. And quite strong ones in three countries of the Maghreb, the North African Arab states, big uprising against the Italian occupation in Libya, uprisings, tribal uprisings in Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, which were all crushed, and an uprising in Baghdad, and Iraq in 1942, at the height of the Second World War, which was very ruthlessly and immediately crushed because it was hampering the war effort. And the, you know, Rommel's armies were not too far off in the desert. But this proto-nationalism, which arose at that time, was of extreme importance for the seeds that it sowed in that region. And in the 1950s, you saw a huge wave of national movements, national self, demanding national self-determination, and an end to imperial domination that erupted virtually all over the Arab world, starting in Egypt in 1956. And that Egypt has always been a pivotal country politically in that part of the world, A, because it's of its sort of antique roots, it's very highly respected, B, because of its population, it is the largest state of the Arab world, and C, because of the national movement that erupted under Nasser and the Egyptian nationalists who took the Suez Canal from the British and the French, and that was the last time the British and the French governments took action in anywhere in the world without the permission of the United States. That was the end, because the decision to invade Egypt, to try and take back the canal, to topple the Nasser regime, it wasn't called regime change those days, but effectively that was the plan, So you had an Anglo-French-Israeli invasion of Egypt, and the Americans, I mean the Russians, threatened to rain bombs on London, but that was pure bravado. It was never going to happen. The American president rang up the British Prime Minister, Eisenhower it was, and according to the accounts of that conversation, used barrack room language and told the British to get out within days or weeks of Egypt. And so the Americans ended that occupation. Why? A, because they had not been asked. And B, because they did not want to push the Egyptians into the arms of the Soviet Union, because we were also at a time of Cold War, when the world was divided into two blocks. So for a combination of those reasons, they compelled the British, French, and the Israelis to pull out from Egypt, but the legacy of that remained. And it saw very rapidly movements erupting in the Maghreb countries, a long war in Algeria, fought by the National Liberation Front against the French, one of the most brutal wars in the colonial history of that region, where the French systematically and routinely used torture of the worst kind on men and women to extract information. And finally, that war came to an end because the National Liberation Front could not be defeated. And the settlers, who existed there in very large numbers, had to pack their bags and leave. And it was a conservative figure in France, Charles de Gaulle, who had to end the war, which center-left governments had happily carried on for some time. De Gaulle, realizing that this was an impossible situation, felt that that period had come to an end. So the victory in Egypt and the victory in Algeria spawned and set off, had a ripple effect in the region. The Iraqi monarchy was overthrown and executed. The British were chucked out of Iraq. All their bases, after a year of the new government, had to be removed. It was a huge defeat. A huge defeat for imperial interests. And you then saw a new wave of nationalist governments in that area. Now here again, we have one fixture in the region since 1948, which affected Arab governments and their policies, and that was Israel. Here was a settler state without precedent, created by the British Empire with its help to settle, and long, long before the Second World War, to give the Jewish people a homeland at the expense of the population who already lived there, the Palestinians. The notion put forward by the Zionist leaders, that this was a land for a people without a land, was false from the very beginning, and they knew it. And many, many Israeli historians, including staunch Zionists, have now written books many years later explaining how the Palestinians were driven out of their homes, how the Israeli army in 48 and 49 carried out rapes of Arab women. This has been attested by Israeli historians with access to the archives. Benny Morris, for one, who wrote about it and then said, well, what's wrong? We were a superior civilization. After all, people did it in Australia, New Zealand, and in the United States of America, too. So what's wrong with our doing it? This Israel-Palestine divide continues to play a huge part in the history of that region. And it was the Israeli War of 1967, about which, too, many very brilliant Israeli historians have written, especially Avi Schlein, based at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, which brought about the defeat of nationalism militarily. The Egyptians and the Syrians suffered huge losses, and Arab nationalism never recovered. So I would say that Ottoman phase, the colonial phase, the nationalist phase, and the nationalist phase essentially came to an end by 69, it was over. And the two political groupings in Syria and in Iraq, the Ba'ath Party, a nationalist party, which had taken power, saw their radical wings being removed through force, brutally, and military people taking over. The Assad family in the case of Syria and Saddam Hussein in the case of Iraq. And Saddam Hussein, as is no secret, backed by the West, given a list of all the Iraqi communists by the United States intelligence agencies and helpfully wiped many of them out. And one of his rewards was that to be tolerated in Iraq and later to be used in trying to defeat the Iranians when that time came. So it's been a murky history since that period, and similar developments of a, you know, not exactly the same, in Egypt, where the post-Nasser leadership essentially, with United States help, support, and pressure, did a deal and signed the accords with Israel that took Egypt out of the political picture for a long time to come. And since that period of time, the first leader who did that, Sadat, was assassinated by his own soldiers. And the most amusing reflection on that period came from the veteran Israeli leader Golda Meir, who, seeing photographs of Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Menachem Begin of Israel getting the Nobel Peace Prize, was asked for a comment, and she said they got the wrong prize. Both of them deserved Oscars. And since that time, in the Arab world, you have had unpopular, unrepresentative, despotic regimes of one sort or another, backed in most cases by the United States and the Western powers. In some cases, as in Libya, which we are witnessing horrific things going on, the coup d'etat that put Gaddafi in power was actually carried out on the instigations of Western intelligence agencies, like that of Idi Amin in Uganda. They thought they better control the changeover, and the result was a disaster. In both cases, and particularly in the case of Libya, as I'll discuss in a minute. So for the last 30 to 40 years, we have had a hiatus where you have had a ruling elite, brutal, corrupt, ruling through force, torture a commonplace, and so commonplace and so well known that come 9/11, many people are sent to these countries to be tortured, because they tell me they're squeamish in Guantanamo. So a lot of people were renditioned to be tortured in Jordan, to be tortured in Egypt, to be tortured in Syria, to be tortured in Pakistan, and are still being tortured in the Bagram prison and base in Afghanistan. That was the world that was created and ready to play this role when 9/11 finally happened. And many critics from within and without, and of every political hue, said the Arab people do not like these regimes. Why don't they do something, was the response? Because they are frightened. They are frightened because they've been tortured. They are frightened because they've been killed. They are frightened because they've been disappeared. That's why they don't act. And nobody knew exactly how or when these regimes would be toppled. Nobody could foresee that till the events of Tunisia early this year, when the economic crisis that hit Europe and North America after the Wall Street crash of 2008 began to affect these countries, which were heavily dependent on European banks and loans from these banks. And as the loans began to dry up, you saw a huge rise in unemployment in Tunisia, graduate unemployment, very large scale, and people said, why are we so badly off when those who rule us, these tiny elites that sit on top of us, are so wealthy, so uncaring, and so blinded by their own greed that they cannot see the conditions in which their own people live. And what started in Tunisia lit a spark. I mean, the young 20-year-old stallholder who refused because he couldn't afford to pay a policeman a bribe to set up his stall in a shopping market was attacked, beaten up by the cops, and set fire to himself in protest, saying, I can't live. It's better to die than to live. Things like this had happened before, so it's not new, but the interesting point is how this created a situation where people said enough is enough, literally, basta, no more. And they poured out onto the streets in Tunisia, and within 3 weeks their dictator Ben Ali was on a plane heading for refuge in Saudi Arabia, which is always a good place for these guys because they can easily access their bank accounts. And Ben Ali's fall, and incidentally, and I will return to this, the last message he received from the French, who were the patrons of that regime, or let's say the subcontractors, the last message he received from Sarkozy and Marie Elliott was, don't give up, we are ready to send French help. Our intelligence forces are very good at all this, crushing these sort of things, and just wait, so we are ready to send French help. This was said one day in the French Parliament. The next day, Ben Ali was on a plane out, so the help couldn't be sent. And when French journalists cornered the defense minister and said, why on earth did you say that? She said, I never said that. But it was shown to her, it was on the public record. The effect of the Tunisian uprising and its successful conclusion was electric in Egypt. And there are many reasons for this. But one reason, a psychological reason which shouldn't be underestimated, is that the Tunisians are generally regarded all over the Arab world as incredibly soft, kind-hearted lotus eaters. They like having a good time, and they have it. And people in Egypt said the Tunisians can do it, and who are we then? We can't do it. I mean, this was very common in the week that followed. And in that week, the number of people coming out onto the streets and demanding the toppling of this despot grew and grew and grew. And the Western world watched with bated breath because this was their boy. He's family, said Hillary Clinton. Accurately, for once. They had backed him up. They had kept him in power. He was absolutely essential to the deals they were trying to push through the Middle East on Israel-Palestine. Egypt was, that was their main worry. And the Israeli government, Netanyahu and Lieberman, also said, everything must be done to keep Mubarak in power. Because for so long have they said that we are the only voice of enlightenment in this heart of darkness that is the Arab world, that probably they felt it was not good if another enlightened state came to being too. I don't know. The reason is realpolitik. He was their ally, and they wanted to keep him in power. They didn't care. And attempts were made to keep him in power. What happened? The first envoy sent by the United States whether by the White House or the State Department is still disputed, but it'll come out like everything else does, especially if Julian Assange isn't extradited. They sent a special envoy to talk to Sadat, to talk to Mubarak. This special envoy was a former U.S. ambassador to Egypt, who was now working for a huge public relations lobby, and one of the largest contracts this lobby had was from the Egyptian government to promote its image abroad. This guy is sent as the special envoy of the United States to talk to the regime. He arrives in Cairo, he meets Mubarak and Suleiman and the military chiefs, and he gives a press conference and is asked, "What did you say to Mubarak?" He said, "I told him to stay on." This was later denied, but the Egyptians said he did say it. And for 1 week they started killing people. Between 350 Egyptians died. Thousands were wounded all over the country. And then they pulled back because they saw that far from stopping the uprising, this was merely adding to it. Once people died, then the next day you had millions, and the week later you had several million people out on the streets of that country demanding that the dictator go. It became impossible to save him, and so he had to be sacrificed. And very rapidly the movement spread. Algeria, another French country the French patronize. Morocco, small but important. Yemen, huge demonstrations started up in Sana'a and in the south of Yemen. And the Arab world was on fire. And then when it hit Libya, the Libyan regime, despite its rhetoric, is a traditional despotic regime, which has not permitted any dissent. Governed by one party, essentially the army, dominated by people from Gaddafi's own tribe, which is one of the lesser tribes in the country, and very brutal. There had been massacres in Benghazi 8 years ago, I was told, when I went to give a talk for the British Council at Tripoli. So no one doubted that he wouldn't go easily, but people still assumed he would be toppled. And it would be a tragedy if he managed to hang on to power just through bloodshed, which unfortunately is looking likely at this moment, though we don't know. And Gaddafi, being the slightly loopy figure that he is, can't quite make up his mind who to blame for this attack. He first wanted the backing of the West and said, "Al-Qaeda is attacking me." But, you know, I mean, this turned out to be a joke. Then he said, no, it wasn't Al-Qaeda. Actually, it was a Western plot. But that was also not true, because it suddenly came out that he'd been very closely involved with the British government, funding numerous British educational institutions, like the London School of Economics and Exeter University, being paid millions. This all came out. Tony Blair's great ideologue, so-called, Anthony Giddens, now Lord Giddens, had written a long essay at the height of this honeymoon with Libya, in which he said that Colonel Gaddafi's, I was honored to meet him, he wrote. We had a long interview. He was very cogent and coherent. Giddens is the only person to have ever said that. and he said, his Green Book, which I read closely, is very similar in spirit to the third way that I am advocating myself. So it's not that Gaddafi wasn't being friendly to the West. His son yesterday, angered by a remark of Sarkozy's, here Gaddafi's son said, "Sarkozy's forgotten how much we paid for him to be reelected." He's forgotten, he said, "We've got all the papers and the checks and the stubs, and we're going to show them." So even in the case of Gaddafi, about 15 years ago, he came out of the cold and was very friendly with all these regimes. So it's neither Al-Qaeda nor the West which has tried to topple him, but his own people. And he's bombing them from the air, he's killing them, he's occupying their cities. So the big question that appeared suddenly, something that was unthinkable, was if this is happening in Cairo and Tunis and Algiers, in Sana'a, might it spread to Saudi Arabia? Would the infection spread? And if so, what? There is no way, in my opinion, that the United States would be prepared to let the Saudi royal family go. And that could be bloody. And then you had a rehearsal of what might happen in Saudi Arabia when Bahrain, this tiny little statelet, erupted. Because here too you had a small ruling clique, which had been ruling for ages. It's a big naval base for the United States fleet. And it does its bidding. It does what it's told to do, like all the other Gulf states. But it does so at the expense of a bulk of its population. And encouraged by the events in Cairo, in Tunis, and elsewhere, the Bahrainis came out. First they were attacked, then they were stopped from being attacked, then more people came out, and now the most recent thing is the Saudi Arabians, fearful that the unrest in Bahrain might cross the border into Saudi, have sent in Saudi troops, soldiers, to try and crush the uprising, and only yesterday they killed a lot of people in Bahrain. We haven't had the exact figures yet. Now, the big question is this. If Egypt stabilizes, and if those who toppled Mubarak get what they want, which they haven't at the moment, because what we have is a ruling military council led by General Tantawi, one of the old point men of the Pentagon in Egypt for ages. But people are very unhappy and are demanding that the military relinquish power, that a new constitution be written, that this constitution enshrine in it democratic freedoms, democratic rights, and social rights. That's also a demand. Social rights. The right to health, the right to education, the right to shelter, the right to work. Big debates going on as to whether these rights should be incorporated or not in these constitutions. And then they say on the basis of that constitution, we should have elections. Now, we don't know what's going to happen. Everything is in a state of flux, but these are certainly exciting times. And as for all those who after 9/11 particularly said, the Arabs don't want democracy, or their more extreme versions, the Muslims are genetically hostile to democracy. Very common views expressed largely by neoconservatives in the United States and many of their camp followers abroad. I don't know about this country, but I'm sure a few people said similar things here too. They certainly did in Australia, where I go much more often. But this was very common. I was asked questions at numerous meetings. Can you explain why people in the Islamic world are so allergic to democracy? I said, it's not the people who are allergic to it. It's those who rule them and those who back their rulers who are allergic to it. Because they know what might happen if democracy is permitted. What might happen is the people might elect governments that are not friendly to the West. And that is always a problem for many Democrats in the West. Because democracy these days especially is meant to be controlled. And in the Arab world and elsewhere, it's getting turbulent. And that is not to be accepted. So we shall see what happens. And by the way, this whole argument that the entire Muslim world is somehow hostile to democracy is nonsense. I mean, military dictatorships were imposed in Pakistan one after the other by the United States, precisely to stop democratic elections. In Indonesia, the largest party in the country was slaughtered. Happened to be the Communist Party, with over 1 million members, slaughtered, cold blood in 1965. And then people say, how come all these Islamist groups have arisen? You create a vacuum in the Arab world, you create a vacuum in Indonesia, and the vacuum is filled. And it's filled sometimes by people who you've supported in carrying out these slaughters or wars, and at other times not. But in any event, within Islam and the Islamic world itself, since 9/11, this notion which has got around that the big threat is Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a terrorist group which virtually every serious intelligence agency in the Western world says has at maximum between 2,000 to 3,000 members, if that now. 2,000 to 3,000 terrorists, this is sort of less than the IRA at its peak. It's less than many of the anarchist groups which tormented Europe the early years of the 20th and the last years of the 19th century, carrying out outrages in one country after the other, killing kings, blowing up presidents, prime ministers. So terrorism itself is nothing new. Nor is it restricted to one culture or one religion. Many people carry out these acts. They're wrong, in my opinion, and I've criticized them quite severely. But that is just a fact. And interestingly enough, the origins of Al-Qaeda are in the war waged against the Russians in Afghanistan. And by the way, the situation in Afghanistan, where your country has troops, if you read seriously what the intelligence men are writing in the American media, and sometimes in detailed scholarly reports, this is a war that cannot be won. It will not be won. Just this week, I was sent a copy of a book written by a very distinguished British diplomat and scholar, Roderick Braithwaite, whose credentials are so impeccable that he was John Major's foreign affairs advisor, Blair's security advisor, British ambassador to Moscow. I mean, he's just written a book called The Afghansi, which is an account, because he's a Russian scholar, of the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. And every page of that book, you read it, and you can see what is happening in Afghanistan today, which is why he wrote it. He didn't just write it for pleasure. And he says, in fact, in many ways, the Russians were better than us because at least they carried out social educational projects, which were destroyed by the people we were backing. But they did make a serious attempt to educate women in build co-educational schools and the rest. So he says, from that point of view, not that it was a good thing, but it was a marginally better thing than what we're doing there. So, if a world is occupied, if a world is kept under the control of despots, and the one big reason why that area is important has, of course, nothing to do with Islam or Islamic culture, but everything to do with the fact that the cheapest oil available comes from these lands. If the Middle East was peopled by Buddhists, we would be having a war against Buddhism. So that's the key to that region and why it's such a heavy security item for the United States. It's the oil, which I'll discuss in a lecture at greater length in the next lecture. But that is what has kept the Arab world like this. What of the Islamic parties in the Arab world? If not Al-Qaeda, who? The largest grouping is the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And this exists in virtually every Arab country to one extent or the other. What are the politics of this party? If you look at their manifestos, the dominant factions in the Muslim Brotherhood, in my opinion, are very socially conservative. No big radical demands coming from them. And when you talk to their leaders, they say, we want to be like the Christian Democrats in Europe. That is the model they have for themselves. Or like the Turkish Islamist group in power, like the Indonesians in power. They say, we're no different. I mean, I'm very critical of them. I said, in other words, you just want to come to power and you want the West to back you rather than Mubarak. They said, yes, why not? And it probably will. So it's not the case that there is one monolithic Islamic world. There are many, many different currents within it, of every sort. The one force that is very weak within it, which I deplore, but which is a fact and can't be ignored, is the left, socialism in any shape or form. Very weak, barely exists. Otherwise, you have these new social movements, nationalism, Muslim Brotherhood Islam, openly Democrat parties, aping Western parties, all this exists in that world. And who the Egyptians will vote for when they're finally allowed a new constitution and the right to vote remains an open question. But if Egypt is stabilized as a constitutional republic, the domino effect will be unstoppable. There will be no way in which the West can say, it's all right for Egypt, but not all right for Saudi Arabia. What has the poor population of Saudi Arabia done to deserve this? Why shouldn't that wretched monarchy be got rid of by its own people? I'm opposed to the West intervening to topple governments. It's much, much better, we argued. I've always argued this, if the developments are organic, coming from within the country itself. And how many people said we have to invade Iraq because the Arabs are incapable of getting rid of dictators at that time? They can't do it. Some European politicians were particularly strong in arguing that. Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister especially. Very pleased to see that lots of anti-war activists are going into bookstores in Britain and putting his autobiography from the biography section to the criminal section. He is a war criminal. Let me say it bluntly. If you have an international war crimes court which only tries people who you don't like, that court has no validity. When Cheney lied through his teeth on numerous occasions, when Bush backed those lies, when the British were forced, British intelligence and British Foreign Office officials were told, you have to find the smoking gun. And they lied. And they took their countries to war. And a million Iraqi dead might not mean so much to people who live in the Western world. A million Iraqis dead, 5 million orphans, 2.5 million people wounded, 4 million refugees in the neighboring countries alone. This is the liberation of Iraq. And had they waited, the Iraqis might have done it themselves as this flow happened. So that is one lesson that we have to learn from the events that are taking place, is that it is best always, in virtually every circumstance, unless there's something very exceptional, for people to get rid of their dictators or unrepresentative governments themselves. Always better. And I hope that the discontents in the Islamic world today, who are showing many other parts of the world how it can be done, will succeed. It's early to say. I've compared this to the 1848 uprisings that took place all over Europe against the huge empires, especially the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but not just it alone, where a new mood is created, a new change takes place, and that gives hope. I got an email just 2 days ago in Perth from Croatia. I had no idea this was even going on, saying, do you know what's going on in Croatia? It was by a Croatian philosopher friend of mine. He said, every single day, more and more and more demonstrations, supported by everyone, virtually, he said, including the right, the left, the center, everyone's out on the streets demanding an end to the corruption and an end to the criminal mafias who run our state. And it's growing. Did you hear about it? And I had to write back and said, thanks for telling me. I had no idea. And he said, he wrote back and said, and it's been inspired by the events in the Maghreb and in the Middle East. That's what's inspired us. And so, once again, the world is on the move. And history, which is always original, doesn't repeat itself. It echoes through the ages. It never actually repeats itself. Is on the move now in the Arab world, and we don't know where it will end. There might be defeats in store, probably, certainly in some of the countries. But the fact is that the people have rediscovered their voice again. They have learned how to speak for themselves, and they have got rid of the political leaders who were imposed on them. And that in itself, I think, is an enormous victory and triumph. Thank you.
Please support www.radiochomsky.org. In your opinion, what role has Al Jazeera played?
Look, I think they've played an important part in giving information, which should be the function of every media network. And the big advantage of Al Jazeera is that it has film crews in every single Arab country, so that when something erupts, they're there to capture it. And often the West doesn't. And in many cases, the BBC was forced to get footage from Al Jazeera to show it on British television because they didn't have a crew there. And then it becomes very difficult to get crews in as well. So I think the fact that the overwhelming majority of the Arab population watches Al Jazeera undoubtedly helped spread the news. When Al Jazeera was first launched, it was very critical of all these regimes. And when Al Jazeera used to go on in Algeria, I know this, and in Egypt too, electricity, they had a very popular program called Hard Talk or something like that, in which they debated these issues. And in Algeria, they used to switch the electricity off in three large cities so that no one could watch it. That's how much they feared it. But now the more interesting question, if you don't mind, would it have happened if Al Jazeera had not existed? I think it probably would have. The Tunisian thing certainly would have happened, and news of that would have spread, if not as quickly. And then a related question is, which there's been a lot of talk about, it was Facebook that did it. Well, you know, in every single period of political upheavals, people use what they have to communicate with each other. You know, during the old slave uprisings in Haiti and some of the French colonies, they used to communicate with drum beats, send out messages via drums. In other places, it was word of mouth. In other places, it was newspapers. In other cases, it was letters carried from one village to the other. And now modern technology has made communication simpler still. You just send a text message. And the Egyptian government, of course, knew this and persuaded the crony to whom they had given the Vodafone franchise in Egypt to switch off texting on Vodafone. And for 3 days, no text message were sent. It didn't have any effect at all. you know, it just delayed things a bit. So even if these things didn't exist, it would happen, but it certainly facilitates them.
Do you think the recent events in North Africa are going to give an opportunity for Islamic intellectuals to return to their countries of origin? And will they go?
Okay, the question, I mean, the basis of the question is, would all the intellectuals in exile from the Arab world, most of whom, by the way, seem to be in London, but not always, you know, will they now start going back to their countries if they open up? And I think the answer is yes, some of them have done so already. Number of Egyptian friends of mine in London have gone back. Others will go back as soon as the situation gets clearer. Lots of Tunisian exiles have gone back. The Libyans obviously haven't, but they're waiting to see. But no, that is one of the sort of good things, you know, side effect. That it's true, you know, the city where Arab intellectuals, in dissenting intellectuals, used to gather used to be Beirut. Beirut was once their center, and no one touched them there. I mean, the publishing houses in Beirut were freer. They had their poetry, their novels, their political essays published in Beirut, and that continued to a certain extent, but there was a lot of repression too. So then they moved to London around Edgware Road. That became a huge, huge Arab center, and they're there. If you go to Edgware Road, and the cafes there are packed with Arab intellectuals having the discussions they can't have in Damascus or Cairo or any of these places. And there's huge excitement. I mean, I was in Paris the day Mubarak, 2 days before Mubarak fell, and he had to broadcast to the nation. And some Maghrebian friends took me into a huge Arab cafe in Saint-Denis. This is, you know, historic region of Paris where the French kings are buried, whose graves are now cleaned by Algerians and Moroccans, because the French state ignores them. That's quite a sort of funny thing. But the cafes were packed that night. There was no one out on the streets. And I went into one of them. The whole place was tuned on, watching all the channels. Let's see what the French channels are saying. Let's switch to Al Jazeera Arabic. A palpable sense of excitement. So I think that will happen once things settle down.
What influence does the current situation of the World Bank and its financial influence have on the events you have discussed tonight?
None whatsoever. The World Bank has had no effect on these events. I mean, it's a financial organization, and whatever you may think about it, it doesn't intervene on this level anywhere. I mean, so it hasn't had an impact. The more interesting thing is what impact it might have once you have elected governments in that region in the term of giving loans and all that. And that will, of course, depend on those who run the World Bank. I mean, there is a strong case to be made to have more than one bank. And I think the argument which the South Americans are putting up, and which the Chinese government at one time played with, of having huge regional banks, having an Asian bank, well, a proper Asian bank for Asia, a South American bank for the Americas there, and so regional banks, I think, are probably more likely to be helpful, but till that happens, we wait and see.
What do you make of the positive and ecstatic response of the Western media to the current revolutions in the Middle East?
Well, I'm very pleased, to be honest, because, you know, it would be horrible if they were all attacking them. If you're suspicious that anything the Western media does, we have to be very careful about. I mean, you know, I understand your instinct, but these are huge, huge uprisings. It's very difficult for journalists who go and cover them not to be affected by what they are witnessing and seeing. You know, it's so I think that most of the press reporting, and certainly in Europe, has been pretty good. The ones who've been lukewarm have been Fox in the United States.
That's a surprise.
Very lukewarm. So you should be reassured by that.
Please expand on your points of 9/11 finally happening and the Israeli government of Netanyahu and Lieberman.
Well, I mean, I made a reference.
Oh golly gosh, yes, 9/11 was an inside job, but it is bloody heresy to say it.
A brief reference to 9/11, based on the work of Chalmers Johnson, called Blowback. I don't know whether anyone's read that book. Chalmers Johnson was, for a long years in his life, a senior consultant to the CIA. Worked largely in the Far East, a scholar of Japan and China. And then he left the CIA and became a professor in an American university on the West Coast. And about 2 years before 9/11, he wrote a book called Blowback, in which he said, we've been doing so many horrible things all over the world. It wasn't predicting it in that sense, but just generally, that do not be too surprised if it finally comes home in some way or the other. Don't be surprised. And he outlined some of the things that had been happening. As for Netanyahu and Lieberman, I referred to their upset at the fact that Mubarak was being toppled. I mean, you can just have to read the coverage in the Israeli media. And in Haaretz, which is, you know, one of the best papers in Israel, some of the commentators there were very good. But that was an exceptional case. And some of those commentators in Haaretz actually wrote about what their colleagues were writing and said, for God's sake, you can't have it both ways. There's no democracy in the Arab world and keep Mubarak in power. So that is what I was referring to.
Do you think there is Western concern and support for the Libyan government to push back against the uprising to prevent it spreading to the rest of the Middle East?
Support for the Libyan government where? In Libya? Yeah, obviously. I mean, it's a civil war situation. And the military, which is what Gaddafi is using, I mean, if you look at even Libyan television coverage of the so-called demonstrations in his favor, very tiny. I mean, really small. Even they couldn't expand these pro-Gaddafi demonstrations.
Support for the Libyan government from the Western world to push back the protesters?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that is going to happen, and that's a sensible decision. It would be foolish to do that. This is for the Libyan, you know, it's an awful thing, but it's for the Libyan to sort out, and Gaddafi may win this particular round, but he will not win the battle, even in the medium term. He is totally isolated. And you know, I mean, the first speech he made when the people were pouring out onto the streets of Tripoli, I don't know whether you saw it. He said, hello. It's raining, and he had an umbrella in his car, and he said, I can't come and address you as I would like to because it's raining. Go back home. I mean, you know, it's frightening, quite honestly, for this guy to be taken seriously even by his own family is ridiculous.
You mentioned only under exceptional circumstances should revolution be encouraged in Islamic countries by the rest of the world. At what threshold do you think this is a possibility?
Well, I include Libya in that assessment. I mean, quite honestly, the example of Western interventions in the world recently doesn't encourage one to believe in them. I mean, I thought everyone would see that, given what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is not a good thing. And they're big danger. Already Gaddafi is using the no-fly zone, saying, look, look, now it's not Al-Qaeda, it's the West. They're threatening me. You're trying to topple anti-imperialist regime and all this guff he's coming out with. And I am not in favor of the West going in there. It's not his business. The other thing he's saying, they want to steal my oil. I mean, his oil is available on the world market already. It's not being kept from anyone. So all these arguments are being used. And I don't believe in so-called humanitarian interventions. They always lead to more abuses and more excesses.
The West should not intervene because they already have blood on their hands. So whom you'd be best to intervene or ask for assistance from the region?
Well, it's very difficult to think of who could intervene. I mean, the UN doesn't do anything without the Security Council, and there's no way the Security Council is going to agree on this in any event. I mean, I think the best way to isolate Gaddafi is very strict sanctions. totally to isolate the regime. That is the best way to help the Libyans people. That's what they're demanding. I mean, if there were a clement neighbor who one could say, go in, help the Libyans, and then pull out immediately afterwards, as has happened occasionally in the history of the 20th century, then I would be, it should be given serious thought. But there is no clement neighbor in the case of Libya at all. The Egyptian army isn't going to do that, for God's sake, and no one would want them to do it either.
Do you think Britain is brave enough to pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan without the support of the USA?
No.
With the large suppressed masses and only a tiny elite, why hasn't socialism taken root in the Arab countries you have spoken about tonight?
Well, it did. It had taken root, but quite a lot of it was destroyed by force. The largest communist party in the Arab world was the Iraqi Communist Party. When it was founded, its leadership consisted, since we use those terms now, of Iraqi Jews, Iraqi Christians, Iraqi Muslims of both the Shia and the Sunni variety. It was the one party which united Iraq, and they were very strong inside the Iraqi army too. And they backed the nationalists when they seized power in 1958 and played a very strong role in that country. And their big rivals were the Baathists. And many people argued that had Iraq done what the Egyptians are demanding now, by the way, got a constitution through which legalized all parties and forced them to seek election once every 3-4 years, it would have been a much better situation. This was not done, and the leadership of the Ba'ath Party and its intelligence wing led by Saddam, this was revealed by King Hussein not so long ago, before he died, were given a list of all the communist leaders and intellectuals in Iraq who were to be wiped out and destroyed by Saddam before he would be tolerated. And, you know, being what he was, he did it. And that's one reason the left in Iraq was, you know, virtually decimated. I mean, thousands and thousands of people were killed. So it's not that that tradition was not there, but it was defeated both politically and militarily and through police measures. And then the collapse of that whole world in the 90s changed everything for the whole world. And it's only now that some ideas are beginning to be revived again, when people discover that the end of the Soviet Union and the communist world doesn't mean the end of imperial hegemony, doesn't mean the end of capitalist crises. Many of those things carry on even without all that, and then so some of the ideas are now in an interesting way being revived again, largely, I have to say, in South America.
What do you think of the leftist governments of South America offering to mediate with Gaddafi, and whether they should be?
I think their intervention was very weak, actually, and I was very critical of it. I think the big mistake both the Cubans and the Venezuelans made was to imagine that Gaddafi was some sort of slightly loopy, well-meaning figure, which he's not. And they ignored the fact of the repressive of that state. And I did write a private letter to both people concerned, saying you're completely wrong, you've got this wrong. It is not the case that he is any different from Mubarak. And just because he said nice things about you doesn't make him all right, as his people are attesting to every single day. It's a huge mistake, and you should think about it very seriously.
Do you see the roles of the separate aspects of Islam, such as Shias and Sunni, being significant during the current conflict?
Well, you know, this is a very recent phenomenon. It started basically with the Iranian clerical revolution of 1979. Prior to that, very few people, including in the Islamic world, spoke of Sunni or Shia. I mean, Baghdad in particular was a city where there were lots of intermarriages between Shia and Sunni. It was not such a huge deal that it has become now. And one reason for that, is that because Saddam had repressed the Shia religious organizations, they were a natural ally for the United States when it finally took the country. And some of the death squads, which cleared out neighborhoods in Baghdad with the support of the occupying authority and their people there, were quite horrific. So this now has become a big issue. But in other parts of the world, I mean, it was very interesting, even though the majority of the population in Bahrain is Shia, the big chant of the people in Pearl Square before they were crushed yesterday was, neither Shia nor Sunni, we are Bahrainis, we are Bahrainis. And that is the attitude of many, many people within Islam who belong to different... And it's not just Sunni and Shia, by the way. Within the Shia, there are many subsects. Within the Sunni groups, there are so many sects and different schools of thought that often they don't pray in the same mosque. You know, you go to the big mosque in Damascus and they'll tell you, oh, that's the mosque where this particular sect prays and we have to keep this reserved. This is where they... So this has been going on for ages. And you know, Christianity has known its own equivalent of that in the long, long wars fought between the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation in Europe, after the birth of Martin Luther and the Tudors in England. And these wars cost a lot of lives, and I just hope that there will be no repeat of that within Islam.